This episode is brought to you by Groove Washer, the best record cleaners and protective sleeves for your vinyl collection. Ask for the Groove Washer from your local shop or go to groovewasher.com. Discount code VinylGuide10. And now, on with the show.
You are listening to The Vinyl Guide, the weekly podcast where we talk record collecting and various music nerdery. My name is Nate, your humble host, and this is episode 376, featuring a conversation with Spike Slauson of one of my favorite bands of all time, Me First and the Gimme Gimmes. Now, those of you who know of Me First and the Gimme Gimmes know what kind of conversation this will be and are hopefully already getting the beers ready from the fridge and preparing your ears to hear the wisdom that flows from Spike. Those of you who aren't familiar with Me First and the Gimme Gimmes, oh, how I envy you as you are about to discover one of the greatest bands in the history of humanity. Me First and the Gimme Gimmes. Google them up. They are a cover band originally conceived by Fat Mike and Joey Cape and have had various members throughout the years, including Jay Bentley of Bad Religion, CJ Ramone of the Ramones, and Chris Shiflett of Foo Fighters, and more importantly, No Use for a Name. Me First and the Gimme Gimmes are a fantastic cover band doing songs from the likes of Whitney Houston, Paul Simon, Billy Joel, and all in a hardcore and extraordinarily enjoyable vein. And on top of that, Me First and the Gimme Gimmes are a fantastic live band. So Australia and New Zealand friends, they are in our cities in the month of February. Wollongong, Sydney, Canberra, Gold Coast, Brisbane, Melbourne, Torquay, Perth, Adelaide, Wellington, and Auckland. Go to sbmpresents.com for tickets and dates to Me First and the Gimme Gimmes. Oh, and hey, if you like Spike and the Gimme Gimmes, you'll love some of the other interviews and episodes of the Vinyl Guide podcast, including Jerry A. Lang of Poison Idea, episode 372, Gerald V. Casale of Devo, episode 366, East Bay Ray of Dead Kennedys, episode 355, Brian Baker of Bad Religion and Minor Threat, episode 351, Keith Morris of Black Flag, Circle Jerks, and Off, episode 352, Fred Armisen of Saturday Night Live, Portlandia, and More, episode 289, Ian MacKay of Minor Threat, Fugazi, and Discord Records, episode 281, and lots more. Subscribe and follow the Vinyl Guide podcast in your podcast app. Scroll, download, listen, and enjoy. So, here we go. You wanted the best, you got the best. Here's the Vinyl Guide interview with Spike Slauson of Me First and the Gimme Gimmes. This week on the Vinyl Guide, we have with us Me First and the Gimme Gimmes frontman, Mr. Spike Slauson. Spike, thank you so much for joining us today, man.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, all good. Look, Spike, you play on quite a few rare records. A lot of the records that you've been on are quite collectible. Are you a bit of a record nerd yourself?
Obscure, you mean? Yeah, I don't know. I like music, and records are good mementos for it, but like, I don't know if it has to do with living in the Bay Area, man. There's a lot of record collectors here, and so to call myself one would do a disservice to the very accomplished record collectors that are here in the Bay Area, you know, the very accomplished, pretentious arrogant record collectors that are here. No, I got some records I dig. That's about it. I don't know if, you know, how many are of any value other than, you know, the sentimental or, you know, historical value to me. So, no, I got some records, maybe more than your average, you know, Gen Z or millennial, but much less than others my age.
Yeah, fair enough. Look, can you describe your record collection? Like approximately how many records and any sort of genres you like to go into more than others?
Man, you know, like well under 1,000 records. Mm-hmm. But it can run the gamut from like Autograph to Dolly Parton to, you know, like in a single, like you could flip one record and the genres and like they kind of there's no there's no real thematic unity to it. Mm-hmm. Lately, I've been buying a lot of sort of Latin stuff and world stuff, and I never thought I'd be that person, but there you go. You never know, things are going to come full circle. Like cumbia stuff, like old cumbia stuff from the 60s and 70s. I guess a lot of people are into that now, but there's a reason, because it's so good and it's different.
So when you go into a record shop, you know, and I don't know what your favorite record shops are in the Bay Area, but like when you go into one of those record shops, where do you start? New arrivals? Do you go to the world section?
Yeah. New arrivals. It depends on the shop too. Mm-hmm. Like there's a place up in North Beach that's miraculously still there. That and it's kind of a sister store, which was right around the corner. I don't know if they had anything to do with each other. I'm probably talking out of my ass, but they shut down sort of predictably, because I don't know if you know what's going on in San Francisco these days, but it's like
usually
it's in the
expensive
process of being flipped, if not completely flipped. So anything going on that resembles my sort of culture, so to speak, is pretty boutique-y these days. But like this place up in North Beach, yes, I will go to the world section because they have a really great, and you could always find something like a Ray Barretto record or some cool Italian thing, or, you know, yeah, usually new arrivals is where I end up. I don't have the patience to like pop rock and to do all the letters of the alphabet, you know. I generally forget what, you know, what I would like to find, and just like new arrivals is as far as I go.
Is there any album or artist that you would kind of credit to inspiring your frontman persona?
Wow. A lot of it is in the outfits. German Schlager culture, I would say, is definitely an influence, at least in the context of the Gimme Gimmes. And it's not because I like the music per se, but I love the presentation and I love the covers of the records. And I love the way the performers dressed and the way they dressed the stages up. It's like, it's German trash, you know, like pop culture trash, which is, you know, like nobody has anything on Americans as far as trash culture goes, but there's definitely some contenders, Italy, Germany, and their Schlager culture. The like our visual presentation, which owes a lot to our wardrobe guru / manager, Audra Angeli Morse, could be called a form of American Schlager. And there's some really great record covers from the 70s and 80s. I don't know if Hino would qualify, but like Hino is definitely like, you know, and it's unlistenable, but like eminently, you know, watchable.
It's kind of a cheese irony, but like you say, Americana, except for when it's very clearly, you know, something European.
Yeah, it's just, yeah. I guess you could say that. As far as the persona, yeah, I don't know. But at least initially, and I don't even know if I was doing it so much deliberately, but it was sort of removing the irony from what would be, because I don't really like John Denver or Neil Diamond. I don't have anything against them, you know, or Barry Manilow, you know, even in an ironic way. But so maybe the trick was to remove the irony from the equation and sort of sing it and present it straight up.
But I mean, there is irony in there. I mean, if you're taking a love song that was the theme of 1,000 high school proms and turning it into bringing it over to more of a hardcore kind of beat, there's irony just within that. It makes
sure,
it fun.
Sure, but I just show up. You know what I mean? I just work here. You know what I mean? So like my job, I felt, was to unironically bring the bring these songs that I did not like by artists that did not appeal to me into my column, you know?
So when you're choosing Gimme Gimme songs to cover, do you look for the songs that you don't like? Or how do
generally
you
speaking, yeah, like AM Gold, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's and some of those songs I like, and some of them even unironically, but it like, yeah, I think the process of bringing them over to something I can relate to is maybe the chemistry that at least to begin with was what worked.
Mm-hmm. I mean, in the early days, you guys had a lot of 45s. Yeah, like John, yes, a sort of A and a B side of John Denver and A and a B side of Paul Simon. What was the, I guess, the conversation like early in the days of Me First, just to get the records out there, to make a name for the band?
That was basically it. And to do it on a bunch of different labels, mm-hmm, and to make them limited runs. So we were kind of gaming, you know, people's record collectors' expectations and desires. Mm-hmm. And covetousness, you know what I mean? So we limited the runs. We stole them from the covers from other collectible records or just dollar bin records, and released them on different labels so that they would have sort of a wider reach, which ultimately made the release of the record much smoother, if that makes any sense. You sort of pick the best of what you released on the 7 inches and release a record, and it's category, you know, already in the first place are already hit songs, recognizable hit songs. So kids would bring them home and play songs that their parents would recognize. So for better or for worse, that was I guess a talking point in certain households. But yeah, that like 7 inches, I mean, and I think back then, like 7 inches have never been a moneymaker. They've always been sort of more of a promotional tool, but, no, not so much. I don't know who buys 7 inches or 45s anymore.
So with those early singles, like you're working with Fat Mike, who clearly has his own record label, but it was in the design early on to give, you know, to work with Side One Dummy or Epitaph or Kung Fu Records. That was part of the design of getting the name of the band out there.
Yeah, exactly. That was, as soon as I showed up to work the first time, that was already sort of on the table. That was a plan that was in the works. And I think it was a good one. And I think the song choices were excellent too. You know, like I would still, had it been up to me, I would have picked songs that I like. That makes sense, right? You know, but mm-hmm, that was, anytime I tried to do that, it was a miserable failure because the songs that I liked, I liked them because they were done. You know, I can't speak to Mike or Joey's, to their calculus in choosing the songs. I do know that they dug those songs, but we grew up in different households, man. Like my parents were sort of like classical music. My dad was very into classical music, very into computer music, like kind of at the start of it.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom, luckily for me, turned me on to the Holy Trinity of the Beatles, the Stones, and the Yardbirds. Yeah. Which was, so that was the kind of stuff, and then Irish music too, traditional Irish music. So very weird, but not, you know, no AM rock, right. You know, that was considered, it was considered kind of square by my mom. And then it was considered sort of like just too rudimentary by my dad. So it just wasn't stuff that got me play.
Do you remember the first record that you brought home? The one you bought with your own money?
Paranoid.
Okay.
It was either Paranoid or it was For Those About to Rock, We Salute You.
Do you remember, like, you know, going out to get it? Do you remember the feeling of it? Do you remember being deliberate about a purchase?
Yeah. It was in a store that kind of scared me because when you went into the back during Christmas time and saw the Christmas cards, there was like Santa fucking a reindeer. You know what I mean? Like, there was like, and like the cover of the records. Some of those were really scary too, like some of those early Scorpions records, you know, it just this, it kind of felt forbidden, mm-hmm, you know, and, you know, and obviously sort of alluring. And yeah, I definitely remember that. I don't remember why I picked Paranoid of all things. Maybe it was Iron Man. And like For Those About to Rock, I had heard it on the radio. And yeah, I played the shit out of those records.
Did you know you always wanted to be a bit of a performer, an entertainer?
I guess so. I always knew that music was such a big thing in my household. I knew I'd be involved in it somehow. But given my youth experiences that are probably in common with a lot of people that play music or performers, they could probably be very similar. So you're like, you sort of crave positive attention and positive feedback, you know? Maybe because you're missing it, like in school or, you know, in your social life, which I didn't have much to speak of. So
Where were you in terms of the siblings? Were you the only, the oldest, the youngest?
Oldest by 2 years of two siblings.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I didn't have an older brother or sister to show me stuff, but I did have friends. God, one in particular that lent me like hundreds of records. So I ended up like a lot of the stuff, the sort of really seminal for me stuff, like punk and hardcore music, I got no record of. I have no records literally of that time because I taped them from a friend. I think I got like Fresh Fruit for Rotting Vegetables with the heads still attached. And that's like it, you know, which is pretty cool. I think that's probably, you know, it's definitely, I don't know how much it's worth, but it's got sentimental value for sure.
Oh, 100%. Oh, we just had East Bay Ray on the show and we were talking about those collectibles, especially the cherry red ones with the heads. Yeah, that's the one. That's the one.
I got that from way back when, and not a whole lot more. I think I had Husker Du 8 Miles High. I remember that. That was pretty good. And I played that for my guitar teacher, who was a Birds fan. And he got so pissed. He hated it.
That must have been a pivotal moment for you as well. Seeing the reactions.
Yeah, it was. It was. Because he was kind of a long hair, but he was kind of a fucking square by that point. By the early mid 80s, which is when I sort of was discovering different kinds of music and going out to the weird Rust Belt punk honky tonk, which in retrospect I was lucky to have had that kind of experience rather than the relative ease that some people, especially out here where I live, like now in San Francisco, the relative ease that they had of discovering things, and like it was kind of all arrayed in front of them, whereas where I was, you kind of had to go to the margins, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was lucky for that.
So moving to the Bay Area, I mean, all of a sudden you're immersed in this culture that you had to try to seek out where, Philadelphia or other places that you lived?
I lived in Pittsburgh, never lived in Philly. I think even in Philly, it was more, you know, kind of on demand, you know. You get your ass beat in Philly the same way you could in Pittsburgh, I'm sure, but for looking a certain way. But no, in Pittsburgh, you really had to look for it.
Right. Now, when was the first time that you got up on stage? What was the first band that you fronted?
It was like a Kiss cover band back sort of at the, you know, when people were doing that, you know. But we played the Electric Banana, which was the punk honky tonk in Pittsburgh that was the first place I ever saw a punk show. It was on stilts. Like it was on the, like you'd enter and you'd be on the first floor. I don't know if you know anything about the topography of Pittsburgh, but it's like cliffs and mountains and hollers and stuff. It's like the outer edge of Appalachia. And so like you can enter through the front door on the first, you know, the ground level. But the back where the stage was on stilts over on, you know, a cliff. It just was kind of out of the way. The singer, it was a weird place. The singer for the band Half-Life, which they were kind of the preeminent punk band when I was going to see local punk band when I was going to see shows. He got shot in the head. I mean, it grazed him and he lived, but like
Jesus.
It was a really weird place in a weird time. And then supposedly, and it's the story that I go with, I don't know how true it is. It's probably some embellishment, but the guy whose bar it was did not roll over on the Pittsburgh mob and went to jail. And when he got out, he was given a go-go bar, married one of the go-go dancers, and then they started doing all ages shows at the behest of a CMU punk band of the time. Then, you know, a few years later, I would see shows there. The first show I saw there was Saccharine Trust and Black Flag. And wow. Black Flag were on the Slip It In tour. And I remember because you'd get a record, and that was sort of like a touchstone because you'd have a catalog in the record of mm-hmm. other like FST stuff, you know?
Yep.
And seeing Black Flag and listening to Slip It In, there seemed to be kind of a, you know, unity between the artwork and the music, you know, but it wasn't necessarily so with all the SST bands. But I remember Ray Pettibone having a real sort of effect on me to the point that I even bought a skateboard, one of those like skate decks, mm-hmm. and it broke the first day. The very first day that I went out to go try to go skating on it, it had this really cool picture. I forget who the actress was that he did, you know, mm-hmm. a portrait of. But yeah, I remember that being very affecting. Alternative Tentacles too. Very like there was something else out there, right? You know, that was not Yes or, you know.
When was the first time that Fat Wreck came on your radar?
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey everyone, I'm here to talk to you about Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Ever find a record in a used bin where the vinyl is gorgeous, but the sleeve has this ugly split and is even falling completely apart? Well, that's okay, grab it anyway, because with Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips, you can fix that right up. Seems Easy record repair strips repair seam splits from the inside, so it doesn't affect the appearance of a record sleeve, but it does make it functional again. With Seems Easy, records can now slide in and out like new. Turn a $5 record into a $25 functioning collectible. Just ask your local record shop for Seems Easy strips, and if they're not in stock, go to seamseasy.com. That seems easy with two Z's. Seems Easy record sleeve repair strips. Seems easy because it is. Oh, and hey, record nerds, don't forget to clean your records with the very best and safest record cleaner, the Groove Washer. Make your records look and sound their very best and store them with confidence using the new Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves. You gotta try this out. It makes a huge difference to the quality of your vinyl experience. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store and accept no substitutes. Or head over to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE. 10.
All hail the Groove Washer.
That's groovewasher.com, discount code VINYLGUIDE10.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. When was the first time that Fat Wreck came on your radar?
I was working at a record distributor that carried all sorts of stuff. That carried them... Mm-hmm. Posh Boy, I don't know if you're familiar with them from Southern California.
Yeah.
Bomp, also from Southern California. Susie Shaw would make us Christmas cookies. And Epitaph, which it was even prior to that big Offspring record, I think like people had discovered that I don't remember what it was called, but like they had discovered it sort of after it had been released for years. And then like an Epitaph even prior to that were selling tons of records. And then mm-hmm. that I think at that time only had like one or two releases, but those were guaranteed sellers. So it was definitely on my radar at right. the time. And then when I quit that job, because it was a fucked up job for a fucked up company. Then Mike asked if I wanted to do shipping and receiving at FAT because I had, you know, some experience with it. And then I did so poorly at that job that that they had to have me front their cover band just so that I wouldn't do any more damage.
Or you sending records to the wrong people and just mislabeled packages?
Yeah, no, I did. And I sent like merch shipments, in some cases, I think, to the wrong continent.
Oh, God.
Which, you know what, they're counting on those, you know what I mean? Like that. So at the time was kind of a big deal. So they had to give me a lateral move so that I do, you know,
yeah,
I do less harm, which I guess is the case.
Give me the tape gun. Here's the microphone.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
So what was that conversation like? What was the first time that you recall speaking to Mike about what became Me First?
Man, like, so he called me down, you know, and it felt like it was going to be another sort of like, you know, last stop towards, you know, until I get fired. You know what I mean? And instead, it was him and Joey approaching me about this idea that they had had. And Mike had seen me. I used to sing covers in a band with a couple of the dudes from Psychotic Pineapple. I don't know if you remember that band. Mm-hmm. They did a song called Dropout that was really good. That first record is like a lot of great songs, like a weird Bay Area, like Missing Link band, like punk per se had not happened quite yet. Like, I don't think the Nuns or the Mutants, you know what I mean?
Right.
Were doing shows yet. And the guitar player, Alex, still had a Brian Jones haircut. You know, so just like a weird sort of Bay Area anomaly. And anyway, so I and then some people from the Rubinews would come up, and Mike had stopped in. Mike Lavella, another local record collector of note, and the former editor of Gearhead Magazine. I don't know if you remember that. Mm-hmm. He's the guy that would bring. So like, I worked with him at the record distributor, and he would bring Mike to these cover events upstairs at the Paradise Lounge, which is also where I met my wife. So fast forward to me working in the record warehouse, and I would sing along to Stevie Wonder and Alice Cooper. So I guess they sort of like, you know,
they want to do a project.
Took a gamble, thinking that this guy maybe can sing, and so asked me if I wanted a new job, a new position.
So how long after that conversation did the first single come out? I think the first single was Denver. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. I believe you're right. And not long, actually, because the like one of the perks of being in a cover band is that you fast forward straight to presentation, which a lot of people stop there and never get into that, mm-hmm. especially like original, like songwriters. You know what I mean? Like exactly what David Bowie didn't do, man. Like David Bowie wrote like this incredible body of music and then went the extra, you know, 100 miles of figuring out how he was going to present it and bringing a show to people. Whereas a lot of people that write original music, depending on the, you know, the genre or the idiom, you know, they wear board shorts, you know what I mean?
And right. Right.
And full comb hats, you know what I'm saying? And that's not necessarily, you know, it worked for a time.
Well, you guys didn't have to write songs. You didn't have to argue about arrangements necessarily. You just had to say,
exactly.
Oh, you want to do Barbra Streisand? Let's do it's E-A-D. Okay, all right. Speed it up. Let's go.
All right. Let's record. You know what I mean? Or let's play a show. That was essentially how it went. And as far as presentation, like at that time, it wasn't anything more artful. Like, you know, than, hey, let's wear some Hawaiian shirts. You know what I mean? Like, so don't get the wrong. Don't let me give you the wrong impression. Like, that was as far as presentation went at the time. I think we've come a long way since then.
Sure.
But yeah, with you know, when the songs are done, you just basically, you can hit the ground running.
Right.
Yeah. You know?
So the first single, Denver, that's 1995. And then you guys drip-fed a few other singles over 1996, 1997, seems to have sped up in anticipation of the album. What was Me First doing kind of in those early days when it was just a single or two? Were you guys playing live?
Yeah, we here and there, we played. I remember I think the first shows that we played were here in San Francisco and then down in Los Angeles. I mm-hmm. lost my voice for that one too, which was kind of a drag. At that, not long after that, in 98, I joined the Swinging Udders and played bass with them, toured, recorded a little bit. That was about it.
Okay.
You know, hung around.
Now, have you ever heard from any artists that were either, I guess, impressed or had a, you know, appreciative, or artists that had a real difficult time with a Me First cover?
The only response that I know of has been negative, and that was from the Eagles when we asked them for a sync license to do a video for Desperado. And they could have just said no, but their management responded and said the band not only, you know, is denying you the sync license, but want you to know that they hate your version. So that's it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can make what you want of that. Like, I definitely made what I wanted out of it, which was that was, you know, a badge of honor, you know?
It wasn't just a no. It wasn't just a hard no. It was a hard no plus fuck you.
Yeah, precisely. Which it couldn't have come from a nicer bunch of guys. Aren't they the guys that are responsible for ticket fees and like merch rates too? Like, it's always your own, man. Like,
you know? there's some weird shit going on inside the Eagles. So, but you've never heard from any other artist that was that, you know, liked what you did or had a positive response?
No, nor have I been interested, man. Maybe Dolly, you know, if she dug it, I'd be all right with that, you know?
Yeah.
But otherwise, I'm not impressed.
When you guys are going into a
Billy
new
Joel, all right. If Billy Joel dug it, you know, maybe that means something. You know, he was a big deal. Like, growing up in Pittsburgh, I remember Billy Joel kind of blew my mind. But, like, there's also a weird thing I've noticed. There's sort of a dynamic where East Coast people who kind of see the world the way I do can't stand Billy Joel the same way that West Coast people that see things the same way that they hate Fleetwood Mac. You know what I mean? And whereas the opposite coasts forgive, you know what I mean? Like, West Coast people love Billy Joel because nobody that listened to Billy Joel, like, you know, ever beat them up and like peed on them or, you know what I mean? Or something like that. And then Fleetwood Mac is just kind of representative of like the West Coast and hats. You know what I mean? Like that hat cancer that's going on in Southern California right now. I think you can kind of like chalk up to like that sort of like business hippie look that Fleetwood Mac had and that sort of mediocrity that they sort of like espouse. And it's not even the quality of the music, man. You know what I mean? I could see how people would like Rumors and that it's got like sort of some kind of musical value. But for some reason, the thing that it triggers in people, in the listenership, is total mediocrity, I think, you know, which is like it's weird. Things like Bruce Springsteen, man, whose music never really spoke to me. But eventually, ultimately, I came to understand him as that's like the Bob Dylan of people that stand up when they work. You know what I'm saying? And that was like growing up where I grew up, like I didn't really like them growing up with them because I wasn't one, you know, like my parents were eggheads. But having somebody that spoke to them, to these people that were enduring this like historic injustice, was definitely of value. Same thing with like Bob Marley. Like, I don't really like the dude's music, but I have a lot of respect for, you know, for what he did. And I would never denigrate like the musical quality of it. It's just not that it, you know, doesn't speak to me.
Well, I think the two of the artists you just named, you know, Bruce Springsteen and Bob Marley. Yeah, I'm not into their music either, but they have a significantly high strike rate. Like the music that they put out is beloved by so many, Whereas if you take someone like Fleetwood Mac, they had a huge album with Rumors, and that was great, and a couple of hits on either side of it. But by far, I think a lot of what they've done outside of that is pretty dreck. It's almost kind of like a clock, a broken clock is right twice a day. That's how I feel about
Fleetwood Mac. Like, they needed to go into the L.A. basin and live life a little bit. You know what I mean? Like, rather than, like, lock themselves away in whatever it was, Laurel Canyon. I don't like any of that stuff, man. And I feel like that era, that's the era that people are recalling with these fucking hats, dude. Like, what are they doing? You know? And vests. And long hair and vests. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying? I know you know what I'm talking about. And like browns and mauves, you know?
Patchouli
oil. Exactly the opposite of what the Gimme Gimmes are trying to like. We're trying more for like, I don't know if I would say John Waters, although like that's definitely always in the back of our minds. But certainly German Schlager culture. But definitely a kind of Americana, maybe embodied by like 70s country, you know, like 70s American like country, because it wasn't it, there was a kind of like city kind of was kind of cityfied, you know, like big productions, and like Hee Haw was different. But even that was like kind of a production, you know.
Oh, fully, fully. And I could see the impact of a show like Hee Haw on me first, because there is that. That hilarity and not taking yourself so damn serious.
Yes, we don't. Yeah. Ironically speaking, because of the unironic delivery that like, you know, and then you see boys and girls beating the shit out of each other to a Barry Manilow song, man. And that's ironic, but they're not being ironic. You know what I mean? Like their experience is not ironic, but like viewed from above, you know, by some divine figure, there's got to be some irony in that. You know what I mean? So it's just in the service of irony.
It folds in on itself so many times.
Yes.
So look, Spike, I know you've only got a few minutes left. I'd love to have you back on the show and talk a little bit more about Me First. I absolutely adore this band, and I'm very stoked to see you guys coming out to Australia starting the 3rd of February. You guys are hitting all the spots or all the major cities, Wollongong, Sydney, Canberra, Gold Coast, Brisbane, Melbourne, Perth, Adelaide, then swinging over to New Zealand. You got a lot of good memories here in Australia?
Yeah, the Antwoord haircuts, man, in Melbourne. They're everywhere. You know what I'm talking about, right?
I do. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And all the cool stores turned into restaurants, man. Like, what's going on out there? What's that strip out there?
Oh, Chapel Street?
The first time I went out there, like, there was, like, still, like, but you could, like, the scent was in the air, like, you know, you could see which way the wind was blowing, and now everything is a theme park, you know, restaurant.
There's something, you know what I mean? Like, there's plenty of places. Just make a friend there, and they'll tell you where to go. In Sydney, same sort of thing. Yeah, don't stay in downtown. Go to Newtown and Erskineville.
Yeah, I love Newtown, man. Spewtown.
Well, we're looking forward to having you, Spike. Again, I'll reach out. We'll do another part two. But looking forward to see you in Australia, man.
Much appreciated. Thank you for your time, man.
Take care. See you.
You too.
Oh, man. I cannot wait to see these guys here on the Australian tour. Again, sbmpresents.com. Australia, New Zealand, do not miss Me First and the Gimme Gimmes. And for the rest of the world, you're going to have to wait until they show up in your city. But make sure you follow Me First and the Gimme Gimmes across social media and pounce on the opportunity when they're in your town. That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm going to ask you all to please leave a positive review on iTunes. Sign up in there. Give us, I think it's 5 out of 5 or 10 out of 10 stars. Say something really nice. Say something encouraging. That is always appreciated. Oh, and please share these episodes on social media. Share them out on Facebook, tweet them on Twitter, talk about them in Reddit, subreddit, format, whatever they are. I'm not a member of Reddit, I'm sorry, but I hear of you.
post stuff in there, people read it, so that would be great if you guys can do that. Post them in Facebook groups and all sorts of other places around the interwebs. That is always appreciated. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some music, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.